Welcome. This is Mark Steiner. As we enter our conversation, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you locally by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, so it belongs to you. More information at www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on the banner. Their banner, it's right there. We're going to talk about Trayvon Martin in a number of different ways here this hour. It is 1 month since he was killed. There's a rally going on downtown Baltimore. The rally is going on across the country for Trayvon Martin. Many looking at it from many different aspects. We are joined here in studio by Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Assistant Professor in the Department of American Studies at UMBC. Dr. Michelle Scott, Associate Professor of History, also at UMBC. We are joined by phone here in the beginning of our program by Suzanne Merkelson, who wrote a piece in Republic Report that was just fascinating to me, Time for Business Behind Shoot First Law to Take Responsibility. And we're going to talk about that, and we welcome them all to our show. Welcome all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join us. Before we go to our two guests, we're going to stay with us an entire hour, Kimberly and Michelle, let me turn to Suzanne Merkelson. I want to appreciate your joining us here at the last minute, but when I saw your article, I said, please try to find you so we could talk to you for a few minutes here. Because this is an aspect of this tragedy that no one is focusing on. Talk to us a bit, Suzanne, about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and what it has to do with the Stand Your Ground law that was what was used as an excuse to kill Trayvon Martin.
Well, I think more and more people are kind of realizing exactly what ALEC is, and it's shedding some light on ALEC's priorities. Paul Krugman wrote a great editorial today, or a great opinion piece today in the New York Times that I encourage you to check out as well. So ALEC is a very secretive organization. It has an enormous amount of influence in writing and promoting laws at the state level. We know very little about ALEC and which companies are members of it, but basically what it does is it's an organization that connects state lawmakers with corporations. So they basically work together to write and promote different laws. Often they're very ideologically conservative. So the Stand Your Ground law was originally written in Florida and then used as a model. a model for other laws in other states. So it's versions of it exist in 23 other states right now, and they're pushing it across the country.
Well, and I want you to please invite Michelle and Kimberly to jump in on this as we talk to Suzanne Merkelson in the beginning of our program. But what this is really important to me when I read what you wrote, because we're talking about a coalition of organizations that make up of some of the largest corporations in America, make up some of the most right-wing foundations in America that push this law, that are pushing the laws that for state voter ID, which will disenfranchise people of color, young people and disabled and elderly around the country, that are really, and there's millions of dollars poured into this from some of the largest corporations in America. So this is not just a group that goes in to try to influence government. I mean, in many ways, they are the corporate shadow government we keep talking about. Mm-hmm. And this is... And I had no idea about the connection to this libertarian Stand Your Ground law until you wrote about it.
Yeah, I mean, they have their hands in all different kinds of legislation that you wouldn't really think makes sense for corporations to be involved with. You know, when I was reading about this as well, I was thinking, what does State Farm have to do with a bill like this? What does Johnson & Johnson have to do with a bill like this? And both of those corporations and many other that, you know, make products that we all use, we all like, are members of ALEC and aren't very forthcoming about what exactly they hope to achieve by their membership in ALEC.
Do you want to join in, Kimberly, for a thought?
I'm fascinated, too.
One of the things you're talking about here, other people are talking about in this, is to try to convince some of these large corporations from Exxon and all the rest to get out of ALEC, to stop contributing to ALEC.
Mm-hmm. So my organization, United Republic, through our blog, republicreport.org, today we partnered with a few other organizations to send a letter to all the corporations that have members on the ALEC's private enterprise board. So we think that since 98% of ALEC's funding comes from corporate members, that companies like the ones I mentioned before and many others, which you can see more of on our website, they shouldn't be involved in an organization that pushes laws like Stand Your Ground. So we ask them to publicly end their collaboration with ALEC.
What has been the response from groups like ALEC in all this? I mean, what have been the response from groups who fund ALEC and are the groups we're talking about? What have they said?
Well, we're still waiting to hear back from a lot of the groups that fund ALEC, from the organizations that fund ALEC. But ALEC itself released a statement today saying that it was, the law was misapplied, which, I mean, I'm not a legal expert. I'm not one who's, ready to make that decision. But what I do know is that these corporations shouldn't be funding this secretive organization that basically writes laws like this that have absolutely nothing to do with the public interest.
One report I read said that over 100 people have been shot or killed because of this law, and that ALEC gets, as you wrote in your article, $1.4 million from ExxonMobil.
Yeah, it gets millions of dollars, and it's all funded, primarily by these corporations.
The Koch family, who are funding all the right-wing push across the country, the Allegheny Foundation. I mean, but some of the corporations are huge. Walmart, Johnson & Johnson, mm-hmm. Bayer Company. I mean, we're talking about some of the largest, Pfizer, some of the largest Peabody Energy, where all the miners were killed in West Virginia. This is something that I think that is under the radar screen of most of America.
Yeah, and I think it's one thing for the Koch brothers to be funding an organization like this. That's not really surprising to me. It is surprising though that Coca-Cola has been involved with this in the past. Why does Coca-Cola need to be involved in pushing legislation like Stand Your Ground? I don't know.
Well, I don't either, but we certainly want to keep on top of this. I really appreciate what you wrote and appreciate you taking a few minutes with us this evening.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Susan Merkelson, Associate Web Editor at United Republic. I'm here at 410-319-8888. Kimberly and Michelle, let me start with you, Kimberly, and go to Michelle. I really want to hear your thoughts on this month after this, and what your reactions were from the very beginning to where you are now.
I think my reaction in the very beginning, of course, was directed immediately to my own 7-year-old son and what his experience in this country will be, which I think many of us have already thought through or thought about. I remember last week hearing an NPR piece where Donna Britt talked with her adult sons and explained to the audience that she had had the talk with her boys when they were 11 years old, to just give them a heads up or forewarn the children that, our society looks at them very differently. And in fact, there's been a study done to show that, really interestingly, for our young African descended boys in this country, around the age of 8 or 9, there's a shift that happens where we no longer see them as these cute little boys running around, having fun, enjoying life, but they then become a threat or are seen as a danger to society. And so when I think about my 7-year-old who's about to turn 8, that becomes a concern in terms of how people will relate to him and how, should I be having the talk at 8 instead of 11? When does that conversation happen? And I think since then, I've found myself just really focusing on what we see happening with the federal government trying to become involved in this particular case, which I really don't see their role, to be honest. And I'm offering a perspective where I find it problematic that the only time we place value on a black body, in particular a black male body, is when we can label it or place it under the label of a hate crime. Because that then, to me, says otherwise that body doesn't have value. And it should have value no matter what. It shouldn't just be under this label of a hate crime. And so I'm very concerned that we have to take this route in order to find or raise questions about the inside of what happened in this particular incident and whether or not Trayvon Martin's life means something without having to apply it to issues of race.
That's very powerful. Let me come back to that thought. I might want to explore that in some depth before the hour's over. Michelle Scott?
Hi, hello.
Hi.
I think some of my initial responses were similar to Dr. Moffitt in that you think of, in my case, nephews, cousins who are age 5, 6, and people who were born shortly after the election of President Obama, who could see themselves visualized in that manifestation, but yet you still have to have the initial conversation of what does it mean to be a young black boy and what you can and cannot do and what's expected of you. So it was a more visceral reaction. And in the last few weeks, I think I've been amazed by the turn that has come from just seeing the discussion that's happened within the African-American community on social network sites, in our own conversations, to seeing that conversation taken nationwide about, again, what does it mean? What is the value of this young boy's life? And what and how does that relate to the laws that, that allow this tragedy to happen?
Let me open the phones. I was talking about some things that have come across the wire in the last recently about the man who pulled the trigger. His side of the story that came out, the piece that Charles Blow wrote in the New York Times today about talking with Trayvon's mother and grandmother, very different kind of pictures of what happened, and we'll come into all that. 410-319-8888. Here in the studio is Kimberly Moffitt, who has been a guest in this show many times before. She's assistant professor of American Studies at UMBC. She looks very deeply into the role of portrayal of African Americans in the media. She's been on the show before. It's co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, and the book The Obama Effect. And we're joined by Dr. Michelle Scott, who's assistant professor of history at the same institution and affiliate faculty member of the Africana Studies and Gender and Women's Studies program. She has contributed to Martin Luther King Papers Project and many other things, and joins us here as well. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And let us go to a lot of people calling in here, so let me see. I'm going to go to somebody who I think we haven't heard from. Clarence, we're going to come to you, but let's go to Angela. You're on the air.
Hi, good Hi. Evening, Mark, and your guests in the studio. I am a single parent of an African-American male, 17 years old. And my son and I, he's soon to graduate from high school. And he and I were having a conversation about this topic when I first read on the Internet or the front page of the Internet that young boy, the caption, a picture of him and a caption saying he was killed for being black. I couldn't even read it. I didn't even want to know because that was just too painful. It sounded too much for me. But what I want to share, as I've been hearing lots of other stories, I don't know what the whole story is. My son was saying something about he was on his phone with his girlfriend, and his girlfriend, he had told his girlfriend that he felt the presence of someone keeps following him, this guy keeps following him, which was the patrol person, because I live in an area where they have a neighborhood patrol like that, just a regular citizen. So my issue, and his, the girlfriend told him something about just put your hood on, which I thought, whoa, no. Because unfortunately, we as African-American people have been ostracized and we have been portrayed as being very negative. I mean, not just to you know, Americans, but people from other countries as well, because I have African friends that tell us that they only show negative images of African-American, you know, males and in their country. This is over in countries in Africa. Anyway, my point I want to say is that two things. This raises an awareness for us as parents to, first of all, I always have the belief that trouble generally does not come into your house and get you. Not to say that anyone cannot be subject to victimization such as this child was, but I think that means that we need to pay closer attention to, number one, because we will want the ugliness and the unfairness and the oppression and all of that to stop. But it's got to start in the home by training and teaching your children the best you can how to, first of all, you know, prevent, but try their best to, you know, travel in a manner in which you're not subject to a crime or just not just senseless things like this. You know, one friend of mine's brother, who was a 27-year heroin addict, said to me, he would stand outside the church looking for assistance. He said, you know, if you keep standing in the barbershop, you're going to eventually get a haircut. So the flip side of that is, if you continue to feed your children the positive things and the things that's going to help them make good decisions, not to say that this boy did anything wrong. Don't get me wrong.
Right. Which answer? Yeah.
And it's horrible.
So it is. And let me just take a piece of what you were saying. I appreciate the call and you being part of the show. One of the things that Joy Freeman Colberry wrote in her piece today for an op-ed for the Washington Post, who's also been a guest on the show before, She's a lawyer, a political activist. She was talking about how Russell Simmons and Cornel West have been opposed to stop and frisk laws for a long time. That when you look at this, that part of the problem is that we have a very racialized law enforcement policy. That young black men are the problem. Or you get people like, what's his name from Fox 45, who I'm blocking on at the moment, but it'll come to me in a minute, who blamed it on the hoodie. We've created a law enforcement system, and that even infects the neighborhood watch system, that is a racialized system that does nothing to stop crime, but endangers the life of a lot of young black men in the society. People like Trayvon. That to me is what I see going on here on some levels.
Absolutely. And I think the initial position of this conversation has been conflating the whole conversation of race and racism in ways that were inappropriate, because it doesn't, I can't see into the soul of Zimmerman to explore his particular position of race. But what I can look at and see is that we have racialized much of what we understand about black men in this society. And so by virtue of his presence as a young black male, he is very much seen as a threat. And this is one of the points that I raise in the Black Hair and Body Politics book, when we talk about how the black body gets revered and reviled all at the same time. So when we think about black men in our society, we revere them certainly for their athletic prowess and ability. We revere them for their other talents, whether it is comedic or some other form of acting. We revere it in terms of the perceived sexual prowess of the men as well, but at the same time, we fear their presence, the sheer immenseness of their bodies, the way the body is structured, the fact that we see that body as being dangerous and violent and having attributes that it resides within it that will cause others harm. And oftentimes, it is seen to cause harm, in particular, to other whites.
Michelle, you want to jump in on that before we move to the next caller?
Sure, I see the connection of that duality of seeing both the reverence for the black body as well as the disdain for the black male body linked totally into slavery. But if you're going to have a hierarchy that brings people here for their very labor and subjects them to torment and torture for hundreds of years, the legacy of that doesn't just erase away when emancipation comes. And so you have these bodies who are essentially this blamed as being over-sexualized beings. And they're the ones that the main reason that you see the legacy of lynching, the value is always this: a black man who's being over-sexualized and he is tormenting a white woman. So in this particular case, if you remove the idea of sexuality, you still have the victimized black body and still that legacy of history, just 21st century racism.
Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888. You know which order you're going in, and don't want to have you hang up on us and all you have to say. We're going to go to Jackie, Clarence, Randy, and Russ. 410-319-8888. Jackie, you're on the air. Jackie, did we lose Jackie?
Yes.
Jackie, you're on the air.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to give a slight constitutional and historical perspective. If one looks at Article 4, Section 2, Clauses 2 and 3, you will see statements concerning fugitives running away from labor, that sort of thing. The Constitution itself would not have been written without the consent of the Southern bloc, which was always at the table since the Revolutionary War, you see. So that, of course, has been amended. But keep in mind, to have something amended, you have to have a primary statement which to amend, you see. And the next point I'd like to make is that the Civil War ended militarily, you see, but has continued socially and economically, okay? An example is the Maryland State Song. All you have to do is Google the State Song.
Yep.
And Maryland State Song was actually considered by many historians the most militaristic anthem that the Confederacy used in military campaigns.
Yes.
You see? And the State Song was actually written as a poem in 1861 what was adopted by the General Assembly in 1939. So that shows or indicates what I'm trying to say concerning the continuity. Final thing is this. We must get past the alleged perpetrator, Mr. Zimmerman, in the sense that it would actually be better if he survived prosecution and lived to tell the story of his own heartfelt wrongdoing. You follow what I'm saying? It's like a someone who is in jail and leaves the prison system and is able to tell other people how they went astray. We must talk about revamping the social political system so that these things won't happen again. And you touched on it when you talked about the current laws. But we must think in terms of the cultural ethos, which allows this sort of thing. Black, for example, has not been considered beautiful historically. It's always, you know, I've had a black day. One of the finest connotations I've heard of black is on Wall Street. You know, if you have a black situation on Wall Street, you've made money. But once you leave Wall Street, black is considered to be gloomy and somewhat negative. So I'm going to end what I have to say, and I appreciate your show.
Thank you, Jackie.
Incidentally, our organization will like to interview you at some point convenient to you.
Love to hear you. Thank you so much, Jackie. So I appreciate that. One of the things that when you raised the question of Zimmerman, essentially reading the piece that just came out before we went on the show, that one piece came out earlier today that one of his best friends, who's black, who is a TV anchor where he lives, says he's not a racist and he probably used the word goon, not the other word that he was supposed
coon,
to have been.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Coon is what he was supposed to have said. That notwithstanding, that he's been in hiding and crying for days and doesn't know what to do with themselves since he committed this act. I don't disbelieve that. You know, I think that may be true. And that the next report was that his story is that Trayvon came up to him, they started yelling at each other, and Trayvon hit him. That may or may not be true.
Right.
He might have pushed Trayvon or hit him first. None of us were there. None of us will know.
That's right.
But the point is, there was an armed older man shooting a kid who had Skittles and an iced tea.
But he didn't see him as a child.
No, he saw them as a 6'3", 150-pound black man.
That's right.
Right. Well, his mother said 140, skinny. They called him Slim because he was so little. And I think it's dangerous in some ways to get stuck in the legalities of what happened here and deal with what the larger issue is and what these absurd laws are that allow people to carry guns and shoot who they want.
And claim self-defense.
Because these laws, to me, and I'll see what you all think. Maybe you don't disagree. Maybe you don't agree. Other people may disagree. But I think these laws, in some ways, are a direct descendant of our ability to lynch. People go, what are you talking about? Well, I'm saying that because this whole crazy notion of this, the individual right to carry guns in the street, whether you're legal or illegal, like young hustlers in the street, it's all madness. And we're legalizing it because they're being legalized in states that have very right-wing majorities that think you should have the right to carry a gun anywhere you want to.
Right. And to protect themselves. Against the types that don't fit their paradigm of who they believe is acceptable.
Your thoughts, public. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Steiner.
Clarence, you know I wouldn't forget you.
Just a personal thought before I make a comment.
Sure.
Stephen Stills or Graham Nash, one of those guys, wrote a long time ago, if you smile at me, I will understand, because that's something that everybody does in the same language.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to throw that out there. But I think that when you have these kind of laws, for one, I don't know why they aren't don't contradict federal law in the first place. And I think that when corporate America engages in this, they're way ahead of us. They see the handwriting on the wall that their activities and what they're doing to this society, it not only is going to hurt people, but may be objectionable to some people. So, I mean, as sinister as it sounds, I think they feel threatened and say, well, if there's an objective to our activities, if there is any type of uprising Well, if we don't like a protest, we can always say that we felt threatened. You know, that's sinister, but that's the only excuse that I can, only reasonable reason I can see for them to want to pour that kind of money into having politicians make these kind of laws up. It's a statement to the society. I even bring it back to a comment I made on your show, is when J.P. Morgan Chase made that large donation to the New York City Police Department. There's something sinister going on, and it's coming down from Wall Street. And also, I cannot see why this cannot be classified as a hate crime. When you go back to your vehicle, when you had the chance to walk away or go away, but you went back to your vehicle, got a weapon, and then pursued somebody, then there's something terrible wrong going on the political side of it, when Eric Holter cannot just pick up the phone and say, I want this man arrested, as a hate crime. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm not sure if Eric Holder has that power to do that, but yeah. I think that someone said the other day that there was an article saying that Eric Holder is Obama's black man in the administration, which meant in the article that he was going to pursues these cases where Obama can't, because when he confronts when we come back to this break, I'm curious what you all think about the issue of what Obama should respond to and how he should respond. I've had a huge email exchange with some friends, Ethelbert Miller from Howard University and some others in this email exchange. Some people are saying that, you know, that Obama's failing, he should have attacked this and said that it's a crime of race and gone after it and defended things going on. Ethelbert writing back that, you know, we expect President Barack Obama to defend everything that's black in America. He can't do that, and we shouldn't expect him to do that. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that when we come back. And we're going to first go to Randy, and then we have Russ and Andre as well. But let's wrestle with what we think President Barack Obama should or should not have done in this case. We'll be right back with Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Dr. Michelle Scott. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. On the way back to the show, I remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. If you are first or second-time home buyer, there are homes here in Baltimore for you. So call the Maryland Mortgage Program, 1-800-638-7781. Dr. Michelle Scott's in the studio, Associate Professor of History at UMBC, and a member of the Africana Studies and Gender Women Studies program, as is Dr. Kimberly Moffitt. I had them backwards here, but Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, who's Professor of American Studies, and both at UMBC join us here, 410-319-8888, as we wrestle with this case and and what happened. And it's a couple of issues we really want to talk about here. But I'm going to get to the phones first, and one's going to be what should have been or not have been President Barack Obama's response that people talk about, and B, what Kimberly and I were talking about, which is that it is almost tantamount that young black men don't have the same rights and they have to behave differently than other people in this country in certain circumstances. We'll wrestle with that. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Randy, you're on the air.
How everybody doing?
Very well. Welcome.
All right. Now, let's look at the excuses here. He had on a hoodie. Tavon should have answered his question when he asked him something. Oh, he got out the car and approached him, and Tavon approached him. They are a bunch of excuses. A bunch of excuses. First of all, he did not have probable cause to stop that young man. I mean, since when it became a crime to walk down the street? See, to me, a lot of people are missing the point, because it doesn't matter if he had on a hoodie or not. The fact is that he saw a young black male walking in that neighborhood, which the police department, if you look at the history of that neighborhood, the police department down there always had looked out for that neighborhood, and you could tell by in their investigation, they were so busy trying to look out for the neighborhood that they messed up the investigation. I never saw in my life where a gun was used in a crime and the person was able to leave with the gun that same day. the gun's supposed to be confiscated. Mm-hmm. He didn't have probable cause. The dispatcher told him to stop following him. It's just a bunch of excuses. He was dead wrong, and everybody is missing the whole point. They're trying to cover up something that they messed up from the start. And everybody have a good day.
Thank you so much. Michelle, you want to comment first?
I tend to agree with the caller. I mean, even if you were in a car accident, there would be a little bit more investigation. You just want to know what happened. And the fact that that it's a month later and we're still now just piecing together parts of the investigation is over. I guess I would say it would surprise me, but it doesn't surprise me, actually. It just seems that you don't get to go home after something like that. There at least should be some discussion about the events.
Yeah. Kimberly, anything you want to add? 410-319-8888. Thanks so much for that call. I think that a lot of people who are shocked, but again, you're in a state, they were in a state with a stand your ground law where people can carry guns and say, if you invade my space, if I feel threatened when I'm standing not in my own home, I can shoot you and I can get away with it. And I'm telling you, I've been reading this since it happened, and there are at least 100 cases where this has taken place, maybe more, and people are getting away with murder. And people have used it in all kinds of circumstances to get away with murder. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ. Welcome.
Mark, I kind of want to piggyback on what the last caller said, but let me start by saying that I heard the sponsor of the Stand Your Ground law from the Florida legislature. He was the guy that drafted it and promulgated it. And he said today that this is not a proper application of the Stand Your Ground law. He further stated that the Senate proponent, along with Jeb Bush, the governor at the time who signed this into law, are saying the same thing. So I think he's going to be out on a limb with this Stand Your Ground thing. But the next thing I'd like to say is President Obama is as much white as he is black. I thought he did a masterful job during the State of the Union talk when he not talked about his mother, but his white grandparents from Kansas. So I don't know. The next thing I'd like to say is that I heard Leonard Pitt and I came to tears because when I was teaching my son to drive at age 15 in Georgia, we had the same problem that we had to explain to our sons how to behave when stopped by the police. White kids didn't have to deal with that, but we, as responsible parents, had that duty to our children, and my son resented it to the highest when I had to explain everything to him. But I want to get more directly into this issue here,
mm-hmm.
because to me, this is the second coming of the Rudisheim case that we've got here going on in Baltimore. As a neighborhood watch person, you do not have any authority to confront anybody,
right?
To carry any weapons. I mean, and these are principles of the National Association of Community Watchers, which this guy was not a part of. It seems like he was a self-appointed kind of community watcher, because the first rule is no weapons. You can't even carry a baton. The only thing you can carry is that radio, because your function and your duty on community watch is to observe, report, and be prepared to testify in court if necessary. Further, what the previous caller said is correct. He was told, Mr. Zimmerman, not to get out of his car, not to follow this guy. The police were in route. So I don't understand, personally, why there's this disconnect. If you're a community watch, that's what you do. You have no authority to confront anybody, cause any kind of damage whatsoever. And I think that along with this Stand Your Ground law, we need to get some real strong points of standard operating procedures for people on community watch. Thanks, Mark, for taking the
Russ, I agree with you. And I think that that's something that we never was not pushed enough here in Baltimore, where the young man was not killed, but his arm was broken. And I think that we have to have those procedures. I mean, they have to be strictly enforced and engaged. I asked the mayor about that when she was in this program. I'll just reiterate it now. I asked the mayor about that and whether or not the Shomrim should be disbanded. She said no. I pushed a little bit more because I thought my sense was that they should. My question was, why in a racially mixed neighborhood should there be a neighborhood watch program that is made up of any one group, whether they're Orthodox Jews or just black folks or Caribbean Americans or Arab Americans who all live in this community or Latinos who live in this community? Why should there not be a community watch program of everybody in the neighborhood working together? to ease the tensions and also to represent the community. I mean, there's a lot of issues here, I think, that were never addressed after that case that are more important to me, whether somebody goes to jail or not for breaking a kid's arm, which was horrendous. But there are, I think, there are bigger issues here to address, at least from my perspective. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to, let's see, Bruce, you're on the air. Then Billy and Andrea, are Billy, Nicholas, Andrea are next. Bruce, you're on the air. We have Bruce bottom up. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm glad you, let me turn down the radio real quick. Can you hold on a second?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I had to turn off the down
okay,
the radio.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so far the dialogue's been all one way. So I wanted to offer an alternative opinion. First off, for that young man having to be killed, I can feel sorry for his parents. Anybody that dies, that loses a child, I can understand what they're going through. But everybody's rushing to judgment on Mr. Zimmerman. Did he do it? I don't know. Like a lot of times, most times, the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that he did it.
Wait a minute. So there's another.
No, just let me stop you.
Wait a minute, Bruce, stop.
There's no. I mean, we can talk about anything you want, but there's no question that he did it. He said he did it. Everybody knows he did it.
So no, I understand it could, but there could be circumstances, and he probably could very well be guilty and should be punished. But okay, I'll tell you a quick couple stories. I'll try to be as quick as possible. This is important. There's a convenience store a block away from me. I don't know how many times I've walked in there where young black males or teenagers or young males have attitudes. You walk in there right away because I'm the only white person. They want to challenge me. They have attitudes. They butt up in front and challenge me. And I can't say anything because I'm outnumbered. About a month and a half ago, I'm walking down the street. A lot of times when I walk, I find things for art projects, salvage. I happened to pick up a piece of pipe was laying by a sidewalk about 18 inches long. I walk along the street over to a convenience store down the other end of the block, and I walk by a young black man, and right away, hey, how you doing, home? I didn't say anything to him. I wasn't disrespectful. Walked in the convenience store, came back out, walked back up, turned the corner up to my street.
Okay.
Wait a minute. You got to listen to this. This is important.
But we don't need every detail of the story.
No. So he's waiting for me.
We have a lot of people on the line here.
If I didn't have that pipe, he would have been after me. So all blacks aren't innocent. There is a culture that exists there. I'm not prejudiced, and I'm not narrow-minded or bigot. But then also, too, you have to protect yourself, and you have to be aware so you don't become a victim.
Okay.
Kimberly. I would agree. I don't take any issue with what the caller has said. And in fact, I don't even think the conversation has been one-sided because, in fact, what I think individuals are calling for is a full investigation to find out what are, in fact, the facts. And the way that this was handled by law enforcement allowed one individual who is involved, where the other individual involved couldn't speak for himself, to have the story shared. And so we only heard one side of the story. So if there is a one side that is being pushed, that's the side that's being pushed. That's Zimmerman. And so I think what individuals are really pushing for and why there seems to be such a force or a swelling of support to have this looked into further, whether it's at the state, local state, or federal level, is more so to have us understand what took place. And it's clear that law enforcement did not do what they were supposed to do to fully investigate the loss of life.
Right. And I think that, and Billy, I understand what you're saying too. I mean, I think people have been through circumstances that you've been through, and there are, you know, sometimes I think we perceive young black men are more threatening than they are, and there are also thugs out there. So both those things are real. So I wasn't trying to cut you off. I just wanted to try have you get to the point. I'm trying to be impolite to you. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Nicholas. You're on the air. Nicholas in Plainfield, you're on the air.
Yes, from Pikeville.
Welcome.
So, first of all, I want to say that I don't like the magnification that they are putting on Barack Obama doing something in this case. This is a state issue, and he really has no pull in this. He can make a suggestion, and that may have a lot of influence on the lawmakers and the senators and the mayor and the police department, but he cannot make an executive order to say, you must go in and do this. He doesn't have that power. It's local, state, federal. So it's a different division. But I want to secondly say that this Trayvon Martin case puts raises the issue that we need to not necessarily debate over. Well, we do need to debate over what actually happened, find out what happened, and put Zimmerman in handcuffs. But we need to get rid of this standard ground law, because it's not fair. I looked it up, and about 33 people in Florida got away with this stand your ground law, because you can't ask the dead man. You can't say, so right. What happened, sir? Because he's dead. You can only take the murderer's who's presumed to be the murderer. You can only take his side of the story, which is there's always three sides to a story. One person, the other person, and then the truth. So we need to know what exactly happened. You need to get rid of this law. This is not a fair law. I mean, there's loopholes. Of course, he's not going to admit to murdering. And also, this Zimmerman man, I also looked this up. He called the police 46 times to report mysterious strangers in his neighborhood, all of them African-American men. He did this in a two-month time period, 46 times. So it's not just like he's had a past experience, like caller Bruce was saying, that he's had a past experience. No, he fears black people. He sees them and he gets scared. So he sees us. You can't call 46 times in 2 months and then say I just had a past experience. And no, you're a racist. I mean, and it's terrible that he's walking around not handcuffed, but some lady can throw flour on Kim Kardashian and then be arrested that same day. Or
right.
These crazy things are happening and they get arrested right off the bat. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like it makes me. I'm a 17-year-old high school student, and these things get me riled up because like. It's just all these ridiculous things people get arrested for, and then people like Casey Anthony and Zimmer free. I mean, it just angers me so much.
Well, Glenn, Nicholas, I really appreciate you listening to the show. It makes me feel good that you listen to the program here, and I appreciate your thoughts. Let's wrestle with what Nicholas said at first. What about the argument about Obama's response? You're hearing people at rallies saying Obama should stood up and said something, intervened. Other people are saying, no, he can't intervene in everything that looks black and blah, blah, blah. So tell me what you all think about the issue of Barack Obama and how you think he responded, should have responded in terms of what happened. Michelle, you want to start? Then we'll go to Kimberly.
I will say that I didn't take issue with Obama's response. I really appreciated hearing the perspective that, you know, as a parent, this is how I feel. Or, you know, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. I didn't expect him to say much more than that. I did expect the right-wing types to attack him even for saying that much. But I don't have an expectation for Obama to take up every issue that focuses or has a uniqueness to the black community. And again, I don't want the focus to be just race specific, to make this about there's a possibility that racism is involved. I do think race is involved, but I think the focal point should be, as Obama positioned himself as a parent, that this young 17-year-old did not come home, and why. And what is it about that particular law that enabled one man to walk away and go home and sulk and hide out for a few weeks, whereas another one had to be buried? So I didn't take stance with him at all.
410-319-8888. Let us go. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
I was just calling. I wish I had the patience of Obama. I was kind of disappointed. You know, I didn't expect him to get up there and use 4- and 5-letter words. But at the end of the day, you know, I just felt like he could have put more emphasis on the fact that we're human. You know, this has got to stop. You know, that law is ridiculous. I mean, and I'm not saying eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, but, I mean, you know, Trayvon's mom, you know, does she have a right to shoot him if they run across each other on the street? Because now she has PTSD and she feels threatened. So, I mean, you know, I don't agree with the law at all. You know, and at the end of the day, whether it's race or not, I mean, of course it brings up feelings because, like everyone said, you know, I have a son who's 8. We can all relate to, you know, gosh, that could be my child. you know, or that could be my nephew, or that could be my brother, and, you know, past experiences. You know, it brings all of that up. But at the end of the day, we're all intrinsically related. I mean, if you just close your eyes, if I cut you, Mark, you're going to bleed, you know?
Yes.
If I cut your arm off, you're going to need it. You know, if you cut my arm off, I'm going to need it. We got to give back to just that human characteristic. And it kind of, you know, relates into your previous show, you know, before this one. It's like it's so much fear, so much hatred. You know, we're out, we hate each other's color, we're out scrambling just to try and get this little bit of money, that we don't ever slow down to just value life and respect each other. And, you know, I don't think that previous caller, Bruce, was a racist, but sometimes, you know, just slow down, you know, instead of just running by and making a judgment call, you know, have a conversation. You know, just say, hey, you know, why do you look at me like that? You know, I say that to people that kind of look at me crazy.
I might not say that, but I might say something else.
Yeah, and then
if I say something like, why are you looking at me like that? Something else is going to happen, so I'm not going to do it that way. But I understand what you're saying. I mean, we interviewed somebody on the show recently that Nipun Mehta, who does these wonderful stories, and one of them about this guy, Pancho, who is a Mexican, and he was getting his PhD at Berkeley, and he turns every confrontation into love, and he changes people. When he was being handcuffed by the police, he was talking to them and telling them that they're doing the job they have to do, and then he turned around and said, you know, and he said, what's your first name? The cop told him his first name. He said, I bet you like Mexican food, don't you? As he would start talking, and then he said, well, when I get out of here, I'm going to take you to a Mexican restaurant. They loosened his cuffs and loosened everyone else's cuffs. I mean, there are ways of dealing with things that can diffuse situations. I think that doesn't always work, but they do exist. And I think that, but I agree with you, Andrea. I think that it's time for us to stop. We do get so caught up in all this stuff. We're not thinking about how we can respond individually and collectively to make this a more peaceful place, not allow these things to happen.
But it's so internalized that I think it's difficult for us to have that conversation, because some of it we don't even recognize how complicit we are in participating in the conjectures of how we look at black men and their bodies in this country. And it doesn't take the perpetrator to be white to then read it as that.
Right.
We do it ourselves, those of us of African descent, this gentleman who is now being referred to as Latino. I mean, the list goes on and on, that in terms of what we have received as messages about the black body have simply been digested, and we are responding to it. We are acting on what we have accepted as being fact because of so much that surrounds us that confirms that it is, in fact, fact.
And that internal racism inside the police and in law enforcement itself doesn't make a difference if you're a black cop, a white cop, or a Latino cop.
Not at all.
It fuels it.
Absolutely.
Billy in Columbia, you're on the air.
Taking my call. First things first, I think the powerful entity behind the scene is pretty much the National Rifle Association. The biggest lobbyist there is, and a couple of congressmen in Florida sponsor that ground law rule that needs to be looked at. And also, as far as President Obama making a speech with that, he just generally did a sidestep thing. And, you know, being that it's election year, and, you know, independents definitely needed to sway his way, pretty much didn't help the Florida situation, but at the same time, he said what he had to say and then hopped in a plane to Seoul, Korea, because he is a world leader and have a lot of things in his plate. And, you know, he does have surrogates, you know, like the owl sharpens and stuff like that.
Right.
The situation. So, no, you don't need to get into that. You need to worry about re-election and other matters dealing with the world situation with North Korea and nuclear stuff like that. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. We have only about 2 minutes to the end of the program. We can get one more quick thought before let me let our guests have a final thought. We'll see if we have time for another call. We'll leave us with a parting thought.
Well, I know I had mentioned earlier about the hate crime piece that I know we so easily want to embrace. And again, I just think it's important to think about if we allow the hate crime route to be the route that is always taken, then it really says a lot about how we value black lives in this country, because someone should be able to be prosecuted and charged and prosecuted for killing a person of African descent without any association with race. It shouldn't have to focus just or fall at the foot of, oh, it must be racism in order for us to find someone guilty for what they have done to a person such as a Trayvon Martin. I also think that this does speak mounds in terms of not necessarily what we want, but the fact that we've got the Donna Brits who are having the talks with their son, and then some of the other callers who have talked about the ways that they talk to their boys to raise them so that they aren't being harmed in any particular way. What that ends up doing, which we all do, is it ends up making our world or our young boys' world smaller and smaller because we are essentially saying they are not entitled to the same civil rights that everyone else is in this country. By virtue of having black skin, by virtue of having a particular style or presentation in terms of wearing a hoodie or the pants hanging low, that all of those become markers that then are inscribed upon your body that you are a threat and danger, and now you don't get to live the same way everyone else is supposed to be able to live in America with a certain level of freedom.
I want to apologize to everybody here, including my other guest, Dr. Michelle Scott. The Kimberly's Muffet had the final word tonight. We are out of time. Kimberly's always lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for coming over. Michelle Scott, it's always a pleasure having you on the show as well. Thank you both so much for the work you do in enlightening our society. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
We're about to leave you now. Before we do, I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily contents on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Harrison and Justin Levy. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our interns Elizabeth Walker, Tiffany Means, Alex Pearson. We're engineered by Regis Tucker. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, find information about our guests and what they do, what they write is anyway, go to www.steinershow.org. Right now, stay tuned for Marshall Reeves' Juice. He's coming up with Keep It Moving. Don't want to miss that. Republic Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.